I want to talk about the first time I met you and the circumstance, and you can tell me if you even remember, because I remember vividly.
Do you really?
Oh.
The very first time we met.
Oh, yeah. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Literally. Wow. Today, LeVar Burton is here. If you've been listening to my show, you know that, you know, I've been doing this a long time and have met a lot of people. But my meeting of LeVar Burton and how far we go back is kind of extraordinary. So when I heard he was coming in today, I was pretty psyched because I haven't seen him in forever. And I don't want to make forever go any longer than it has to. So let's get started. Okay, so I am probably 13.
Right.
I'm at Malibu Park Junior High.
Okay.
And I want to be an actor.
Right.
I'm fresh from Ohio. I don't know nothing about nothing. But I'm in all the school plays. I'm in everything, talent show. And there is for sure the most talented girl in the school was one of my best friends, Holly Robinson.
Right.
And Holly would sing Desperado.
Wow.
And Linda Ronstadt would come.
Yeah.
And sit in the front row.
Yeah.
And listen to Holly sing Desperado. Holly's mother, and why Holly's mother isn't more celebrated than she is kind of a, I just don't understand.
She's like the Zelig of modern show business, Dolores Robinson.
Yeah, and
she knows everybody.
Dolores Robinson, I mean, a single African-American mom.
Yep.
Raising two kids.
Moved here from Philadelphia.
Moved here from Philly.
Drove her green Volvo station wagon across country.
With a dream.
Yeah.
So, and she is, now I'm so unsophisticated at this time that I don't really understand that much about Hollywood or what Dolores was or does, but she was a manager.
Right.
And
I was her only client at the time.
Was she... I would see around, and she stopped me in the hallway. I can see it like it was yesterday, the upstairs outdoor hallway in the history building. And she said, I want you to meet someone because next week he will be the most famous person in the world. And it was you the week before Roots came out.
Wow. That's a good story.
And I remember... I just remember, and she was right. I mean, think about it. I mean, it's like,
well,
those are the days when that could happen.
Yeah,
where literally overnight, truly overnight.
Although overnight.
You'd obviously worked. You'd always had a career.
No, nothing.
No,
Roots was my first professional audition.
Wait, what?
Yeah, I was a sophomore at USC studying theater, with an intention to graduate with a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree and move to New York and hustle my way onto the stage. That was my intent and intention. And I auditioned for Roots in early 76.
Oh, my gosh.
Early 76. And that process went through the end of March. I did my first main stage role at USC. I played Ali Hakim in Oklahoma.
I played Will Parker.
Will Parker, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing, sir?
Damn glad to meet you.
Oh.
Wow. We need to take this on the road.
Didn't they call him a peddling man?
The peddler. Yes, that's the Ado Annie called him the peddling man. She sure did.
Ado Annie.
Yeah.
That was Will Parker's girlfriend.
Indeed she was. Madeline Smith played Ado Annie in the USC production, who went on to play opposite John Travolta in what was the cowboy movie he did?
Everybody? Urban Cowboy.
Urban Cowboy.
I remember also that next week, I remember you on the cover of Time magazine.
Right. Yeah, that was crazy.
What do you do? Where do you go from the cover of Time magazine in your very first audition? Talk about being shot out of a cannon.
Yeah. It was pretty extraordinary.
And, you know, for the listeners who weren't alive for Roots and what it was, I mean, it was such a, I can't think of anything that was bigger. I mean, honestly, it was as big as Star Wars.
At the time, it was.
Sure.
I mean, it had an impact. It made an impact. Yeah. And you know, the idea that it was all broadcast in consecutive nights of programming.
And how many nights was it?
Eight nights originally, eight consecutive nights.
8 2-hour.
Some were two, some were one.
Oh, were there some other one?
Yeah. Some were one. They had, I think, 2 1-hour nights. It was what a ride.
I mean, what was it like to go from a regular person to a phenomenon?
It was exciting and heady and really confusing. Frightening.
Yeah.
Even. Yeah.
And Dolores, your manager,
saved my life.
What was her guidance? Do you remember any of it?
She just kept me safe. I didn't know this until fairly recently. But Dolores used to show up at places where I was. She'd like be casually talking to me on the phone during the day and say, "Oh, so what are you doing tonight?" And I'd tell her, you know, I'm going to such and such a bar and hang out. I'm going to the Roxy or whatever. And she would get there before I did and get in the back and just...
Wow.
Right?
She's like a Secret Service agent a little bit.
Yeah. She kept me safe. She kept me safe.
My other really fun Dolores Robinson, too, was I couldn't get a job as an actor, and I was a busboy at the Nantucket Light restaurant in Malibu, which is now where Nobu is.
Right.
And I couldn't hold any job. When I was a kid, I was always, because I was usually flirting with somebody, or you know, eating the mud pie in the walk-in freezer. That's what sunk my ship at the Nantucket Light.
Mud pie has been the downfall of many a man.
I ran into the shoals at the Nantucket Light.
Is that right?
Eating the mud pie.
But
I can remember clearing her dishes as she came into eating and just whispering in her, "Get me out of here."
Well, you had quite a dramatic start yourself. I mean, here's what I remember about you. You were part of a cadre of kids that went to Samo High, right? You and Holly, Matt Robinson, her brother, Emilio Estevez, right?
Sean Penn. Chris Penn.
You guys were...
And you know who gets forgotten? Robert Downey Jr.
Robert Downey Jr., right.
He was in my history class.
What a cohort.
Isn't that crazy?
It's crazy.
It really is. But people ask me about it, and I think it's there are times, you know, on the planet when areas just kind of have an energy. You know, Laurel Canyon in 1968.
Right.
The Byrds lived next door to Jim Morrison, and Jackson Brown had a place in the basement above the Eagles.
Joni Mitchell. They were all Graham Nash. They were all there.
Right. And Malibu was definitely, and there's other people we're not even thinking of. They're like the Dylan kids.
Right.
I mean, there's all kinds of tertiary people that you go, oh my God, you were.
It was a moment. It was a moment in Malibu, in the boo. As the kids say these days.
And didn't Holly Robinson end up doing her first pro job with you?
Yeah,
on
she
Dummy?
Did. Yeah.
Was it Dummy?
She did, yeah. Yeah. Right.
I remember sending her flowers to location. And a telegram.
Really? Where she worked with, she played with Stephen Williams, who ended up also being in Jump Street.
That's right. Now, and also, just a total sidebar, I was looking at your filmography. Were you in Looking for Mr. Goodbar?
I was, yeah.
Tell me what, okay, see, now we're in these 70s, you know, movies in the 70s were the shit.
Yeah, they were.
They really were.
They really, really were.
And you were in Looking for
Mr. Goodbar. I was in Looking for Mr. Goodbar.
First of all, who directed it? I forget.
Richard Brooks.
Wow.
Richard Blackboard Jungle.
Yeah.
Brooks.
Right?
Right? Yeah. Who had a reputation, had earlier in his career had a script, or as the story goes, parts of a script sort of stolen. And so he was very, very secretive. My lines he wrote down and then handed it to me and said, "Here, memorize these." And so I was really excited after production wrapped to get two packages from Freddie Fields, the producer.
Freddie
right?
Wow. Right. Freddie Fields, a legendary agent turned producer, studio manager.
Yeah. So I open the first package, and it's a beautiful leather, brown leather, gold embossed script book with my name on it. And the looking for Mr. Goodbar. So I'm like opening the second package. I know this is the script.
Yes.
Now I can finally read it. There's a cover page and 110 blank pages. And that's Freddie Fields' sense of humor.
I hope you kept. Please tell me it's still around.
It's still around somewhere.
Oh, that's so good. I worked with John Amos much later in life. Played the older version of you, am I correct?
That's correct. That is correct.
What an actor. He's still with us.
Oh, yeah. John, John lives, I think maybe he doesn't now, but for a long time he lived on a boat. Which is just
anybody who lives on a boat, that's a very, come down on my boat. It's such a gangster move.
It is.
Living on a boat.
Yep. You can go anytime you want. You can just peace out.
Peace. That was a great cast.
Lou Gossett, Ben Vereen.
I watched Officer and a Gentleman again last week.
Yeah.
Bro.
Yeah.
Lou Gossett also lived in Malibu.
He did. Lou Gossett, when we shot the first 3 hours on location in Savannah, Georgia, and that's where I met Lou. And then we came back to Los Angeles, and in that first week of shooting here in L.A., Lou took me home to his apartment, his house on the beach in Malibu, just so we could hang out, spend the night, and just spend time together. My very first day as a professional actor, Cicely Tyson played my mother.
Come on, Jesus.
Maya Angelou played my grandmother.
Well, I'm sorry, who? I'm sorry, what?
Dr. Maya Angelou played my grandmother, Neo Boto, in Roots. And that very first day, those were my acting partners. I know.
I'm actually speechless now.
I was 19.
What was that like? Was there any poetry read? Please tell me. Was there any written? Is there a LeVar Burton poem in the archives?
You know what it was for me in those early days. It was being in the makeup trailer in the morning with those women, and just being in their presence was all I needed. I didn't have to eat or sleep. I just needed to be around them and just, absorb whatever I could. And it was like that for the entire 7 weeks. Moses Gunn, G2 Kambuka, Lou, all people that I had admired, growing up and seen on television. It was quite an extraordinary thing. And the weird thing is that I don't remember being particularly nervous. Because if I knew anything at that point in my life, I knew who Kunta Kinte was. I knew who that character was inside and out.
What do you think led to that kind of awareness?
Just my whole life, right? I just knew how this young man felt in any given situation. I just knew. I had that knowingness.
It doesn't happen, but it doesn't happen all the time, does it?
Oh, God, no.
Right?
No.
And then when it does, I'm not sure what to attribute it to.
I think there's I have felt a sense of, I guess, destiny in my life. I'm sure you do, too, that there are things that have transpired that I could never have predicted, and I am in awe of, and the only thing I can attribute it to is that this was part of somebody's plan,
right?
It wasn't mine, not at least not on a conscious level. Because if you had given me pad and pen and said, draw it up, dream up your career, I would not have been this generous to myself.
Yeah, same.
Right?
Oh, same. And My first movie was The Outsiders, and that was a big movie. I thought all movies were going to be like that.
Francis Ford Coppola.
Yeah, I mean,
your first director,
right?
Come on, man.
And you don't.
Come on.
I know. You just don't know. don't even know when the last time we physically laid eyes on each other.
Decades.
But decades?
Yeah.
Decades,
right? At least a couple.
Gotta be, right?
Yeah, sure.
And yet, you know, what a history.
Yeah. Yeah. And a sense of kinship. You know, we haven't seen each other in eons, but you walked in the door. It was like, my God, let me hug this guy's face.
I know. I was so happy to hear that you were coming. It just warms my heart. I was hoping you were going to be the Jeopardy guy because you are like that guy to me. Reading Rainbow, Jeopardy, wordsmith, storyteller.
Yeah.
You know, and I know that's what you feel at your core, you're a storyteller.
Yeah. At my very core. Yeah. That's what I am. That's what I am.
The most important thing that mankind has, the most important thing we do is storytell.
Yeah.
Just on a practical level, without storytelling, how would they know not to go to the water hole where the tiger was?
Right.
Right. And when you look at it from that to what it's become today, it, because that's really what I realize, that's what I do.
It's the oldest art form.
Right.
There is. You know, we started telling stories in the cave, before the cave, right? We started recording them in the cave.
And reading, your mom was the one who got you into reading.
My mom was an English teacher.
That mine
was
too. Her first job. Mine was an English teacher.
Right.
So it's good to have a mom as an English teacher, right?
Best. The best. Yeah.
And it's interesting because you think that maybe they'd screw us up and the last thing we would want to do is read.
Hmm.
But no, I read all the time as a kid. I know you did.
I did, yeah. Yeah. My mom, because my mom always read. She was a reader. That was the modeling that I had.
Yeah, it wasn't like they said, go do it. They were doing it.
She always had a book going, at least once, sometimes two, even three books going for her own, just because she was so voracious about it and had really, she loved Louis L'Amour. She loved her Westerns. But she had really eclectic taste.
Was it your idea to start reading Rainbow?
No.
Or was it a collaborator? They just knew you'd be a good fit?
They had been developing it and they were looking for a host. And there used to be a show in New York on the news called Live at Five.
Of course.
With Sue Simmons.
Sue Simmons, come on. Hello, Sue Simmons.
So I was on my way. I was through New York on my way to Africa. And I was doing a little interview with Sue Simmons and the producers saw it and tracked me down. They tracked me down at the Essex House Hotel.
Like a breath of fresh air on Central Park. It's Essex House.
And they pitched it over the phone, and Dolores and I were like, yeah, this makes sense. And see, here's the thing. Talk about everything happens for a reason, okay? So here I am. I do this thing called Roots. It's my first job. And then these people want me to do a children's television show. Now, Dolores's husband, her first husband, from whom she was divorced, but Matt Robinson was the original Gordon on Sesame Street.
I mean.
Right? So Dolores had this real special place in her heart for children's programming and really encouraged me to do it. And, you know, without that sort of push in the right direction, my life and career would look completely different.
And it ran how
26 seasons?
26 seasons.
On PBS.
It's unbelievable. And then, of course, there's the Star Trek era.
Star Trek thing, yeah. Yeah.
Tell me about the visor. I got to know about the visor. Because I got to say, to me, the visor looked like there's girls in the control booth. What are the things you put when you put in your hair to make your hair? It's not a barrette. Because those are the
banana clip.
Is it? What's the thing?
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. It's like, to me, looked like just a woman's headband they threw on you.
That was the inspiration.
Was it?
It was.
No, it was
it
not.
It was the inspiration.
No, it wasn't.
Okay. Well,
come on, really?
Ask Michael Okuda, the man who designed it. It was inspired by a Denise Okuda headband, a women's hair retention device.
There, you okay? So I'm not crazy.
No, you're not.
See, I always just thought it was one of those things where they were like, they've spent so much money hiring you, your ginormous fee and the sets, and they're like, oh Jesus Christ, we forgot to do the goddamn eye thing for him. What about this? Throw on a headband and like, this works for me, and off they go.
Fram oil filter.
That's what I thought it was.
Yeah, right.
Didn't it ever drive you berserk?
It became my nemesis.
I'm sure. By the first lunch break.
It was exciting at first, and then the real challenge of acting without my eyes sort of landed, and it was like, wow, okay.
Did you have a, I wish I'd have thought, it seemed like such a good idea in rehearsal.
It did. It was like I was so excited, and then the reality set in. And I, what the hell have I gotten myself into here?
Because it's that, I wore an eye patch in Austin Powers.
Yeah.
And that thing used to drive me bananas.
Is it the depth perception thing?
Yes.
Right.
The depth perception. And it's kind of like seeing a little is worse than not seeing at all, maybe?
Yeah.
So did you have like, you had upper peripheral vision?
No, I did not. No. I couldn't see above my head. I couldn't see.
You couldn't see at all?
I couldn't see my feet. No. No. I could see what was right in front of me. And the challenge was to not look for my feet. Right? Because, you know, chief engineer had to know every inch of that ship. And you couldn't see me hesitating to figure out where the ramp was, or, you know. I bumped into a lot of shit in the first season.
That would be a good behind the scenes.
It was challenging. It was challenging.
Did you have any apprehension about that kind of, like, Star Trek being such an iconic thing and doing a rebirth of it? Or did you know this is going to be amazing? Who doesn't want to be a part of it?
I just wanted to be a part of it.
Of course, yeah.
I just wanted to be a part of it. And, you know, I think I had, I wasn't afraid of it because overcoming the stereotype of Kunta Kinte, was the job, you know, that Dolores and I undertook. After Roots, to make sure that I had a career that had any sort of longevity. In order to do that, I was going to have to, you know, beat the tendency. Universal wanted to do the Life and Times of Kunta Kinte, or, you know, a series based on stories, and that I just figured that was going to be the end
before, just as it's beginning.
Just as it's beginning, so.
Was Gene Roddenberry alive?
Yes, very much so.
What was he, did you meet him? What was he
very
like?
Very much, very much. He was, you know, he was that visionary. But one of the things that I learned from Gene was—
Gene Roddenberry, obviously, who created Star Trek.
Creator of Star Trek. They called him the Big Bird of the Galaxy.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. Gene taught me that all of our heroes are human. Because I did revere him. And then I met him, and then I realized he's a guy, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was from that generation of the three martinis at lunch. And, you know, you look at you look at Star Trek, the original Star Trek, all the women wore very short skirts. He was a man of his generation.
Yeah.
Right? So the idea that he could, that both things could be true. He could be this incredible visionary, and at the same time, you know, have the kinds of foibles that most men do. And that was, I think that was one of the most important lessons I've ever learned.
That's a great one.
It is.
I'm going to steal that. I've got a couple people I'm going to use that answer on.
Yeah.
It's a really good answer.
Alex Haley taught me that your authentic voice as a storyteller is the only thing you've got.
Right.
Develop it. Know who you are as the storyteller, right?
Yeah, and that's why actors are just an offshoot, because it's the same thing.
That's right. It's the same thing.
It's exactly the same thing. Now, because I conflate all of the Star Treks. I start to get them.
I get it.
At a certain point. And I go, because Whoopi's an old friend too. And Whoopi was on, and we were talking about her time on Star Trek,
right?
But you guys didn't. Did you overlap?
Mm-hmm.
We were
in the same cast. In the same cast. In fact, it was Whoopi Whoopi and I were talking because we both shared a love for the original track and Nichelle Nichols and Star Trek as an example of pop culture where Black people were included.
Right? Yes.
And that was huge for both of us. And so she said to me, I want to be on Star Trek. Would you tell Rick Berman? And I did, and he didn't believe me.
Oh, right. I remember.
She was like, the biggest star in the fucking world.
I think she just won an Oscar.
Yeah. And she wanted to do television, which was not done back in the
day. No. I mean, no.
No. There was no crossover. So it was...
Whoopi doesn't give a fuck.
Nah.
She just does what she wants.
That's why she's Whoopi.
Right?
It's why she's so free.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
She's... I mean, talk about following your muse.
Yeah. Unfettered. Unfettered.
She was just on the show, and she's another one, like hugging on Whoopi. It's like she's just the best.
Yeah, she and Fred Rogers, and Alex, to a certain extent, I put them in the category of most authentic people I've ever met.
Tell me about Fred Rogers. I never met him.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously between the books and growing up with him,
right?
I was just fascinated that he could time his clothing routine in those opening credits
he wrote the song, so he knew how much time he needed.
Exactly. I mean,
he knew exactly, right? And his mom knitted those sweaters.
People talk about Christopher Walken having an interesting speaking rhythm.
Yeah.
I think Fred Rogers has one of the great speaking rhythms of all time.
Yeah. It was also married with an intentionality of focus. He was laser locked on you when you were in his presence, and you felt the full force of his attention, which was considerable. He was certainly one of the most patient human beings I've ever met, and openly, honestly caring and loving as a human being.
Because he's so embedded in the public consciousness as Mr. Rogers, you keep waiting for the other shoe to drop.
There's no other shoe. He was that guy. See, when I first met him, I was excited to meet the real guy.
Right. Yes.
Because that's got to be an act.
It has to be an act. Yeah. No. Nope.
That was Fred.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I wonder what Mr. Rogers would have thought of TikTok.
Well, you know, Fred was a musician first and foremost, right? So he probably would have dug it. But I call him a saint. He certainly was a saintly individual. I'm just going to go ahead and claim it for him.
Claim it.
Fred Rogers was a saint.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You also played Ron LaFleur.
I did.
Yeah. Great. So that's a deep dive for baseball fans out
Jonathan
there.
Jonathan Frakes is going to be so happy to
Jonathan
hear you
Frakes.
Mention that.
He
loves the Ron LaFleur story. He's a big baseball fan, Frakes.
Yeah. I like Frakes. He's great. And I remember watching LaFleur. I saw LaFleur play.
Did you?
Mm-hmm.
When he was a Tiger?
Yes, when he was a Tiger.
Wow.
Did you shoot in Tiger Stadium?
We did. It was my first experience in a professional baseball stadium.
Tiger Stadium was sick.
My God. So my very first experience at a Major League Baseball park, I come out of the tunnel wearing number 8 at a home game.
What is it with you and your first experiences? Yeah. You know, my first experience, I went to the moon. Yeah, my first experience, I was elected president of the United States. It's unbelievable.
I've had a life, Rob. I really have. I ask myself often, what was it that I did in a previous life to deserve this one? I can't even imagine. I'm genuinely one of the most fortunate individuals I've ever met.
Well, you know, the other thing I'm struck with, LaVar, is you've also seen and done it all. Look, you and I've been around a long time. And this business, to survive, you have to develop, call it a thick skin, whatever can make people super jaded, whatever it does. But you seem unaffected by the journey. I'm clearly you have to have been, because you wouldn't be human if you weren't.
Yeah.
But your sort of like vibe is really rare for someone who has been through what you've been through to get to where you've gotten.
I was forced to figure it out.
Isn't that always the truth?
Yeah, I had to. It was get real or die, right?
Been there, baby.
Right?
Yeah.
And I decided to get real. And I literally went on an extensive period of search and exploration to reach the core of my authentic self and then bring that back to the world.
Yeah, that's it, and that's been my journey as well.
Yeah,
like the authentic self.
See, you will relate to this. I have recently come to the conclusion that my job, Rob, is to show up and be myself.
Dude. Right?
Dude.
No, it occurred to me in the last 5 years.
5 years for me.
Five years. It was like, the only thing I have to offer, really, at the end of the day, there's so many good actors.
Yes.
There's so many thises and there's so many thats.
Right.
The only thing I really have to offer is me.
Yeah. The sum total of my experience and my willingness to share that with others, right? The benefit of my experience.
Yeah, which for me is why one of the reasons I do this, because in learning about others, you know, I learn more about myself, and you know, people get to know more about me because this is the real me talking to you. And writing books is the same. Memoirs are fun to write and not easy, but fun. I'm so glad you're in my book, bro. You're
wow.
in it.
Well,
name checked, baby.
Wow.
There's some good company in there.
I can only imagine some of your stories.
There's some good ones, man. I gotta say. There's some Holly Robinsons in there. Dolores is in there big time. That was a good time. Let me ask you, what is, because I talked about it briefly earlier. What is, as a Jeopardy fan, if you go on Jeopardy, what's the thing that would be the most surprising? Is there something? Is it like I did Family Feud.
Yeah.
It was so, I love game shows, by the way.
Me too.
I love them. And obviously that Jeopardy occupies a whole other, it's the
pinnacle in American game show culture.
It's not even, game show seems debasing to call, or
yeah.
no?
Is yeah. it? It's of a genre, I believe.
Like, I don't even like the term sitcom for comedies.
Okay.
Because it makes it, I know it
cheapens it in some way.
Do you know what I'm saying?
I get it. Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
So there's a little bit of that.
So we'll call it a quiz show.
Ooh.
Right? Jeopardy is the pinnacle in this culture in terms of quiz shows.
How do you have, oh, it's because you read, of course. I was like, what's the source of your depth of?
So much bullshit in my head.
Yeah, yeah. Are you good at Trivial Pursuit as well, or is that beneath you?
No, not at all. In fact, one of the, you know, in the everything happens for a reason department, because I was really disappointed that I didn't get that gig, because I thought.
Oh, I thought it was a lock.
I thought it was a real audition. And then, as it turns out, it really wasn't, because the producer, the guy who, you know, taught me how to play the game.
The fix was in.
The man who said, I'm not interested in the job. My job is to help them find the right person for the job, always intended to give himself the job.
We always, I call that the Dick Cheney experiment.
Yeah.
President-elect, I will help lead the search for a vice president. We will find the right vice president for you, Mr. President. Oh, wait, it's me.
It's me.
It's me. Yeah. It was me all along.
All the time. So, one of the unintended consequences of not getting that job was the phone ringing and on the other end being Hasbro, right? Who said, we have a little piece of IP called Trivial Pursuit and we want to turn it into a television show. We can't think of anyone we would rather have host it. And they made me a partner in the enterprise.
Oh, there you go.
And Jeopardy would have never done that.
Where does Trivial Pursuit, where is it in
we
the process?
We are pitching. We've come up with what I believe is a really good game.
How long did it take to crack the game part of it?
We cracked the game part of it in about 4 to 5 months.
Yeah, I think it's hard, isn't it?
It is not easy.
Isn't it hard?
Yeah. In fact, I think originally, we were going in one direction. I thought it would be very, very cool to not have any, to not be playing for money, right? Let's play for something worth more than money. Let's play for an experience, right? Nah, people want to, you know.
People want money.
People want money.
There's certain things, because I sometimes do a show called Mental Samurai, which is it's trivia under stress.
Wow.
Both a mental and physical stress. And by the way, I love hosting it. Mm. And we've done 2 seasons. We may be doing a third one. And we created the game, obviously. And the things you learn about what works and don't work in terms of a game for people to watch, it's amazing. And it's usually keep it simple, stupid.
Yeah.
It's like our thing was, originally it was, it's an obstacle course of the mind, like a Ninja Warrior, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then we realized, no, nobody wants to watch a game that they go into thinking no one's going to win. It really interesting. Like we need, so in the second season, we reworked the game so there were more winners.
Yeah.
Like turns out people didn't like to see people lose every week.
No, because
what do you know? But you like something you don't think about.
You want to identify, you know, with a player.
Yes.
And in that identification, you want that player to win. For whatever reason, you're attracted to their personality, their the color of their eyes, their smile, whatever it is, they're a stand-in.
Yes.
For the competitor inside of you. Exactly right.
Did you ever have a moment where you watch a contestant flail and it's just, you know, they know it and they're drawing a blank, or they don't know it and they're drawing a blank and you're like, you have to be kidding me.
I've been on that side.
You've been on that end of it.
I've been on that end of it. There was a Star Trek edition of The Weakest Link.
Mm.
I got into the final round with, I don't know if you know the actor Robert Picardo.
Sure, I love him.
Wonderful, yeah, wonderful
he's
actor.
He's a great actor.
And a really sharp dresser and a lovely human being. And the clue was about pre-war. It was a word for pre-war. And I said, as a seminarian, I studied Latin. And I've got to know this. I know it's in there somewhere. And the clock was ticking. And then just as I was about to let go and say, I don't know it, boom, Antebellum came into my head. And it was like, wow, I can't believe it took me that long, but it did. But thank God it was buried somewhere in there.
And it came out almost
unconsciously. Because I had like, oh no, I don't know it. I'm done. And then boom.
I had this, a guy who I believe, it's been a while since I've seen the episode, but he was a NASA engineer, right? Super smart. And it's his very first question. And you have 60 seconds to complete a mental obstacle course.
Okay.
And use visuals as well. And the question is, the prompt is, name this superstar 80s pop duo. And then there was a picture of a long hallway and a bowl of oats.
Hall and Oats.
She's got 60 seconds. Okay. Oh, boy. I'm not really good with music. So there's a hall and bowl of oats. Hallway oats. Cereal floor. Hall. Oatmeal. Hall, floor. Ceiling. 60 long seconds.
That's painful.
And then this is the last one. This is my favorite one. So it's an anagram. You can see the anagram. And it says, this anagram is the title of this iconic 90s ensemble sitcom. It's clearly Friends, right?
Mm.
I mean, it's right there. It's the anagram.
Mm.
60 seconds. And I said, look, you're going down clearly. Don't you want to take a swing at it? Just name something. Because all right. Durfins.
Ouch.
I wanted to redo the Friends logo, you know, with that famous Friends font with Durfins.
But I got to say, you can be really, really smart and not be good under pressure like that.
Yes.
And there is no pressure like the red light on a camera, right?
Yes.
When that red light goes on and you know that it's on you, it's just a whole other level of, I need to perform now.
There's a reason why Stanley Kubrick made HAL a red light.
Yes, exactly right. I never even thought of that, Rob.
Right?
Whoa.
Right?
Yeah.
Just like the all-seeing, all-knowing, cold.
Yes.
Unblinking. Huh?
HAL. Yeah. So I get it. I get it. Pressure can, you know, pressure's a motherfucker.
Yeah, it is. Oh, we didn't talk about the Jim Jones story.
Oh, my
bro.
God.
We have,
oh, my
see,
God.
See, this is the problem when I look. It's funny. I've wondered why I'm obsessed with Jim Jones and the Guyana tragedy. And then it's because I was watching you in it.
Hmm.
It's your fault.
Well, there was a hell of a cast.
Was that the one with
Powers Booth?
Powers Booth?
Yeah, Powers Booth. Diana Scarwood. Irene Cara played my love interest.
If you guys have not ever seen this, try to find it. It is the most disturbing.
It's pretty good.
It's so good.
And Powers Booth was unconscious.
Powers Booth is one of the great actors of all time. And noteworthy, what's the noteworthy sidebar about that?
Well, he was the only actor to cross the Screen Actors Guild picket line and go to the Emmys to receive, because he knew, everybody knew that Powers Booth was going to win, and he was not going to not show up to pick up his statue.
What is the actual title? It's one of those convoluted titles. Guyana Tragedy, the story of Jim Jones. Not even the Jim Jones story.
The story of Jim Jones.
The story of Jim Jones.
Yeah.
That's a great one. Mm. But no, it's okay. You're gonna have to tell me this.
LeVar Burton Reads is my podcast. I say at the beginning of every episode, "Hi, I'm LeVar Burton. This is LeVar Burton Reads." where in every episode, I pick a different short story and I read it to you.
So it's not chapters.
I'm reading short fiction, and I lean into speculative fiction because that's my favorite genre to read when I'm reading for pleasure. I love science fiction, speculative fiction. So and I also love doing this show because there's a whole generation of adults out there now who grew up on Reading Rainbow, and on Reading Rainbow, I used to recommend books to them, and I'm now recommending authors. You know, I pick literature from a lot of different voices out there, marginalized authors, authors of color, women. So I'm still introducing this generation to literature.
I love it. I love it. How have you done any? Have you read any books, audiobooks yourself?
I have. Love doing audiobooks.
I figured you would, right?
Love doing audiobooks. Read. I did the Unabridged Cosmos.
What?
Carl Sagan.
Oh my God!
That was a project. That was an amazing
Jesus.
Project.
Jesus. Amazing.
Yeah. Won a Grammy for the Martin Luther King autobiography. Yeah, autobiography of Martin Luther King.
You get all the heady stuff. They give me like.
Yeah. What? Give me a title. Give me an audiobook title that Rob Lowe has done.
And I'm honored. It's Stephen King. So it's great. It's Stephen King.
Come on.
Dolan's Cadillac, short story.
Yeah.
If you haven't done it.
Nah. Okay.
Dolan's Cadillac.
Okay.
It's in his first collection of short
stories.
Yeah.
I'm on it.
I call it his old man in the sea.
Is that right?
Because it's simply a man with a task. There's no dialogue.
Oh, wow. Awesome. That's awesome. So we're in his head the entire time.
It's him working.
Wow.
It's pretty intense.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Well, everybody check out the podcast. You can get it wherever you get your podcast.
Wherever you get your podcast on, I like to say.
Mm-hmm. I get my podcast on all the time. And we got it on today. And it was so darn fun.
Rob Lowe.
From 1976 to today. I wish you guys could have seen the interview as well as heard it, because his energy, his like I could stare at LeVar Burton's eyes for a long time. He's just kind and just what a great, I feel all warm and fuzzy, like I said. What an interesting, amazing man. Anyway, thank you. I hope you guys had fun. You got questions? I got answers. Let's hit the lowdown line.
Hello, you've reached Literally in our lowdown line, where you can get the lowdown on all things about me, Rob Lowe. 323-570-4551. So have at it. Here's the beep.
Hi, this is Diane from Oregon. I just finished listening to your book. Fascinating. Loved it. I am now watching The Stand and saw St. Elmo's Fire. Damn, you are a wonderful actor. Anyway, in the book, you said you got to see a version of Outsiders that includes the scenes you had filmed but had been cut. Is there a way for the public to see that version of The Outsiders? Thanks much. Hope you're having a great day. Bye.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for that question. Yes. In fact, I tell everybody, if you're going to watch The Outsiders, don't watch The Outsiders. You watch The Outsiders. It's great. But the version that has all of the stuff that we originally shot, which includes everybody's stuff. It's the movie we thought we were making. The Outsiders version that is commonly known as The Outsiders, the original, does not follow the book really at all. So that's why they call the version I'm talking about The Outsiders, The Complete Novel. So that is the title, The Outsiders, The Complete Novel. And I think that has actually now become the version of record in schools that study The Outsiders, because they usually, kids have to read the book in the seventh grade, and then they traditionally show the movie. They're finally now showing The Outsiders, The Complete Novel, which is nice because all my stuff's back in it. Anyway, thanks for the question. Appreciate it.
More fun next week on Literally. So please, but make sure you just download the whole season, would you? Because they're all really super good. But next week is in particular one of my favorites. So I will see you next week on Literally.
You've been listening to Literally with Rob Lowe, produced by me, Rob Schulte, with help from associate producer Sarah Bagar. Our research is done by Alyssa Grahl. The podcast is executive produced by Rob Lowe for Low Profile, Adam Sachs, Jeff Ross, and Joanna Solitaroff at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson at Stitcher. All of the music on this podcast was composed by Devin Bryant. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on Literally with Rob Lowe.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Stitcher.